I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. As we get close to Labor Day, we thought a show on American workers and their pay would be in order. Part of it is because we were thinking of people who are on strike today. Low-wage workers in fast food restaurants are striking in some 50 cities in the country. Also, there has been a Fair Minimum Wage Act of 2013 introduced by Senator Tom Harkin and Representative George Miller. So there's been a lot of conversation about what is a fair wage in this country. That act would raise the federal minimum wage to $10 an hour by 2015 in three steps of 95 cents each. And a lot of this conversation is certainly being prompted because since the recession, we have found that the number of new jobs that are being created are jobs that are in more of a low-wage sector. And it's pretty hard to make a living if you're making $7.25 an hour. So we have two guests with us to talk about what's fair, what businesses will be able to endorse, why the minimum wage is as low as it is, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls. I would think that you'll have more than a few comments on the issue. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Two guests this hour. Professor Frank Emspach is with us, founder and executive producer of Workers Independent News, professor emeritus in the School for Workers at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Frank, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, how are you? It's a beautiful day.
It is a beautiful day. Thank you for being with us. David Newby is also joining us. And David, of course, a longtime labor leader, former president of the state AFL-CIO, and as we discovered in some documentaries over the last couple days, was one of the marchers in Washington in 1963. David, hello. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen. Good to be with you.
Tell me, both of you, why you think there's all this movement now. People are striking today, low-wage workers throughout the country. We're hearing more talk about a federal minimum wage bill, a bill that would increase the federal wage. Frank, why is that happening right now, do you think?
I think people have had it. There's no way to survive. You know, you cannot, sooner or later, people have to say, we're going to do something. And I believe that that is happening, and I also believe that there is some leadership from other sources, foundations like the, the worker centers, and which are in parts supported by labor. There are also some labor unions that have made it very clear that something has to change. The USCW's longtime effort about Walmart, and then support by and others in regards to low-wage workers that are not in any particular union. So I think it's a combination of this is the time. Just one figure, because David and I were discussing this earlier, so David had raised this question. And we broadcast it this morning on WIN. In 1963, and the March on Washington, the minimum wage was a buck and a quarter. Today, if it had been increased for inflation, that would be $9.52.
Really?
Now, it's a seven and a quarter. So what that means is that people working for the minimum wage are earning less relatively now than they were in 1963.
Hmm. I'm going to ask you a little closer to your phone, too, Frank, because your volume is just a little bit low. David, why is it that we haven't seen a lot of the workers who are on strike today been able to form unions? Do you see that coming, and would that help things enormously?
Well, it certainly would help things enormously. Whether it's going to happen or happen soon is another question entirely. The amazing thing is that low-wage workers, particularly in the retail and restaurant industry, are taking the kind of action that they are. They're walking off the job. They're risking their jobs simply because, as Frank was saying, they cannot survive on the low wages that they're getting. And we haven't seen this before. I mean, these folks have never been paid decently. They've never had adequate wages. But you have not seen the level of self-organization and the willingness to take these kinds of risks. It's extremely difficult to organize in this industry, in part because of turnover, in part because of the ownership patterns of, for example, fast food restaurants. Some are owned by the corporations themselves. A lot of them are franchises. And so what they're doing is trying different tactics. and using a walkout of a minority of workers in order to put pressure on the industry and pressure on particular restaurants to raise wages to a decent level so that they can survive and support their families. Because for the most part, these are not teenagers just earning a little bit of extra money. So many of the people, I believe it's over 30%, for example, are over 30. And so this is not the kind of work that it might have been 15, 20 years ago. People are trying to support families on these wages, and they simply cannot do mm-hmm. it.
And they also know they're stuck. I mean, this is the other thing. There's no upward mobility here. If you want a job like this and you were 17 or something like that in, say, 1970, you could look around and see other opportunities. But this is now the end of the line for many, many people. And so when you're faced with that, either your family is going to do better if you do something or not. And I think this is it. You have a workforce that has no mobility and is now forced to fight.
Mm-hmm. Why is it, Frank, let's start with you, that since the recession, 58%, that's a big percentage, of new jobs have been in low-wage occupations?
Well, it isn't only since the recession. It's only more clear. If you look at the projections for jobs, say that were written in 1995 or 2000, and there was all this discussion about all these new high-tech jobs and so on and so forth. But all of this stuff from the Bureau of Labor Statistics showed that the largest increases, and this was before the recession, was going to be in licensed practical nurses, home health aides, retail in the fast food industry, and so forth, and very, very few, relatively speaking, elsewhere. And so I think what you're seeing maybe is not such a new trend, but maybe it's more visible, or maybe it's a little bit greater, but it isn't new. There's been a continuing reduction of what used to be called family-supporting, good, solid, working-class jobs pretty recently since the mid-70s.
Mm-hmm. David, you want to add to that?
You know, it's difficult to add to that because that really sums it up. Mm-hmm. We've seen a shift in the composition of the jobs that are available, jobs that we used to have in the manufacturing sector that were supplying good family-supporting wages are simply not there anymore, not simply by mistake, but as a result of globalization and our own trade policy, which has encouraged the destruction of those jobs and shipping them off to low-wage countries. So we're hollowing out our economy. We're eliminating decent jobs, and what is left are the low-paying jobs that we're seeing today. Plus, we're seeing a few more jobs at the very high end, because, as I'm sure we'll talk later, at the same time as the composition of our workforce and their average wages is declining, that we're seeing a massive shift of wealth up to the top 1% and especially the top 0.1% of the richest people in this country. So we're shifting that wealth up to the top, to those who already have far more than they need. And in terms of jobs, there simply aren't enough jobs that are paying a decent wage in order to keep people out of poverty.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering about the people on strike today, David. Are they protected from being fired?
Well, legally, if two or more of them in concert walk off the job, then according to the National Labor Relations Act, yes, they are protected. It's protected activity. However, our labor law is very weak, and trying to enforce it is even more difficult. We have seen, for example, that Walmart did not take action last year or last spring when we saw the first wave of people going on strike for a day in order to dramatize their needs. They didn't take immediate action, probably because they didn't want the public relations disaster that would result in. But In the last couple of months, they have gradually begun to take disciplinary action and to fire a number of these workers. So they're doing it slowly so they don't get the attention that they would have otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also true that, you know, none of us is a perfect worker. These folks do not have protections from being fired for any kind of infraction. They're employees at will. They don't have any kind of contract. They have no protections of that sort. So even though they do have some protection in labor law, it's very thin and very difficult to enforce. So that is why it's so important that the general population support these folks and put pressure on their employers to not take action against them if they go out on strike today.
The bill that I talked about at the beginning of the show, Frank, Federal Minimum Wage Act of 2013, would call for $10.10 by the year 2015. People who are striking today are asking for $15 an hour. What's fair?
Well, what's there is, and what's fair is this. All kinds of other studies have been done about what does it take to have a family of two, a family of three, a family of four be able to live. And I think what they're trying to look at is what that would be, and what that would be is a minimum of about $30,000 a year. And you still are going to be eligible for all kinds of things. I think there's a couple of things we need to understand. First of all, if you are a low-wage worker and you are working for a company like Walmart or any of the other ones that are making billions of dollars, the public is subsidizing those wages through food stamps or through other types of public programs. So we're paying for that, not the company. And so I think if it's going to be fair here, we're talking about fairness, you at least ought to have the employers paying for what they're getting, or that they should pay more in taxes to cover the costs that they are inflicting on the rest of the population. That's one aspect of this. But the other is to take a look around the rest of the planet, particularly in other countries where you have workers in this industry that are paid decently. And finally, you might think about the Wall Street Journal, of all things, not a left-wing publication, as I'm sure everybody knows, but who came out with a study yesterday that said that the low-wage strategies have now penalized the American economy, because companies refused to invest and because the educational needs were not met. And now we're having increasingly uncompetitive firms in a non-competitive worldwide marketplace as regards skills. So there's huge negative impacts. It isn't just the money. It's a negative impact in many, many sectors of the society that are beginning to be felt.
David, what's a fair minimum wage?
I would agree with Frank that it is a wage which can support a family at a decent standard of living. We have the highest level of poverty in the industrialized world, and it's getting worse. The gap between what American workers are making and what those in other industrialized countries are making is widening, especially when you look at access to health care and education, because even with the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, a lot of people are still not going to have access to health care, although that's going to help a lot. But our levels of the number of jobs we have that are paying poverty wages is much higher than it is in other countries. And as Frank was suggesting, it is not inevitable that these kinds of jobs pay poverty-level wages. It's a question of, can these workers exert enough power within the industry and on their employers to be able to demand a decent wage? For example, auto workers back in the early 1930s were not receiving good family-supporting wages. But once they organized and had a voice in the workplace and a voice in the setting of their own wages, they were able to raise their wages and their standard of living considerably. So it is a real question of power. And in the broader sense, what we have seen since the late 1970s is that with the declining power of the labor movement, that all workers have seen their bargaining power decline. And corporations obviously have taken advantage of this in order to extract more value from their workers without raising their pay.
Do you see that changing at all, Frank? Do you think we'll see more workers being organized in the years ahead?
Well, I hope so. I think we'll see it with this fast food business. You know, you don't necessarily have to have the union in the sense of an employer recognizing you to achieve unionization and decent standards. Let me say it this way. If everybody in Milwaukee, all the fast food workers, went out tomorrow and demanded standards, that is, a wage and a benefits of some sort, and that was so massive, and the franchisees or the owners of the corporation said, okay, we do it, forget it. Well, that would still mean that they would have those standards if it was agreed to, right? But maybe they would then go off and form their own association or union. So it's a sort of a different model, and it's a model that's used in other countries. And so I think we're going to see more organization. Now, what that form will be, I think, is not so clear, but we're going to definitely see more organization.
We welcome phone calls for both our guests. What do you think the minimum wage should be? Is it because, as our guests have suggested, the unions have declined in numbers in the last some years, that it has resulted in all wages going down, not just low-wage workers? We're looking at what people need to live and what the economy can afford, what businesses in America can afford as well. Some businesses have said, you know, if there were an increase in minimum wage jobs, there wouldn't be as many jobs. It would hurt the companies. How do our guests respond to that? What do you think is fair? When we look at that Federal Minimum Wage Act of 2013, raising the wage to $10.10 by 2015, could you endorse that? Would you go higher? Would you go $15? Or do you think that it simply needs to be where it is for the moment? Here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We have two guests with us, David Newby, former president of the state AFL-CIO, Frank Emspach, founder and executive producer of Workers Independent News, professor emeritus at the School for Workers at UW-Madison. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now for Frank and David and start with Daryl in Grand County. Hi, Daryl.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Well, you're a little echoey.
Oh, wait a minute. I had the speakerphone on. I'm sorry. I could tell it was something wrong in the headphone here.
Everything's fine now.
Yeah, okay. I'm very careless sometimes. But in order to keep a number of individuals working in the energy sector, we need to have the high school curriculum that teaches them how to do energy heat loss and heat gain and energy home efficiency audits and these different things, because we have a lot of even new air conditioning systems that are put in that are only getting like 65% of their rated output, and a lot of the installations are not done right. And the thing is that the we also need to start having worker-owned cooperatives. We can do that in a lot of areas.
Frank?
I think he's right. I think he's absolutely right on the high school curriculum. And for sure, the worker-owned co-op is a good way to go. I don't know exactly where you are in Grand County, but one thing that was on the table some time ago was a worker-owned co-op for the repair people in paper mills, so that there would be enough skilled people around to do the repair and unionize and certainly do the repair works in those mills.
And there's another aspect to this as well. The caller was talking about training for jobs that actually create value in our economy. We talked at the beginning of the hour about the fact that the 1963 March on Washington was a march for jobs and freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And we often forget that, in part because of the power of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. That's where people focus, and they forget the larger purpose of the march itself. But there were eight demands that that the march presented to Congress and to the country. And one of those demands was for an increase in the minimum wage, which Frank referred to before, which, by the way, today, if you adjusted for inflation, would be just about $15 an hour. The second thing, though, is that there was a demand that every person in this nation, black or white, be given training and work with dignity to defeat unemployment and automation. We need to get back to that kind of a demand for full employment, for a job for every person who is willing to work, and a job that is going to support that person and their family at a decent standard of living.
Thank you, Gerald, very much for your call. Let's go next to Molly in Green Bay. Hi, Molly.
Hi, how are you today?
All right, Molly, how are you?
Very well, thank you. I'm a 35-year-old server, a single mother of two, and I work for a very large corporation. They charge us a percentage of our gross sales so that they can split that among two other classes of employees so they don't have to pay them a living wage.
What? Tell me the kind of work you're doing. Are you waitressing?
Yep, I'm a server. I'm waitressing.
Okay, and that minimum wage is what, $2? What is
$2.33 an hour.
Mm-hmm. And then you have to split the money that you make in tips with what, people who do what?
They charge us 3% of our gross sales.
Mm-hmm.
So anything that we sell, they charge us 3%. And then they take that 3% and they split it between the bussers and the bartenders.
Hmm.
So we can't make somebody tip for us. If somebody walks out and doesn't leave us a tip, we have to pay for them to come out for dinner.
Ooh. Have you complained?
Oh, yeah. Everybody's doing it. All the corporate restaurants do it.
Uh-huh. And have you complained as a worker? Have you said, yeah, we ought to do something different here?
Yeah, we all do. There's nothing we can do, though. They've got us. They're huge. They're international.
Mm-hmm. Frank?
Well, I think that's one of the problems. And I think that to the extent that the no-wage worker movement gets people together, and raises some of the issues. The Restaurant Organizing Committee in New York had the same issues and has been trying to fight against it, and people have tried different things, whether it's class action suits or claiming wage theft or raising issues of discrimination. Any possible thing is what's possible is the idea here, and I think there is no solution outside of some kind of public and collective protest, and I think I say this, but I want to assure the speaker that this isn't just because it's a nice idea, but having done this at different points in my past, I know how difficult it is. But I don't think we have much of a choice.
I was amazed to read, I just wasn't aware of this, David, that the minimum wage for tipped workers has been frozen at $2.13 per hour for more than 20 years.
That's right. Now, technically, a person who is receiving that tipped minimum wage is supposed to make up the difference between that and the regular minimum wage of $7.25 through tips.
Mm-hmm.
But as the caller has indicated, for one thing, they are being super exploited because the employer is taking away part of that that stream of income for them. And people in the restaurant business don't always make up that difference. And yet there's no real enforcement that is forcing employers in the industry to make sure that even if people are at the lower minimum wage, that they make up the difference in additional income through tips. So there's super exploitation going on in this industry and really in all low-wage jobs.
Well, it's outright greed. I mean, the companies are making billions here. Maybe not this local franchiser. Who knows, you know, but certainly the people franchising, the McDonald's of the world, Yum Industries and whatnot, they are making money. And so when it's not a question of losing jobs here by paying people properly. It's a question of, are people going to be able to live? And the caller raised this fundamental issue. You know, I mean, she's working hard, and somebody walks out, and she's responsible. She's working hard, and some of her tips are basically confiscated. This is just unconscionable. And that's the word that I think we, David, have to get out to people to the extent that we can.
That's absolutely right. I wonder, is the caller still on the line?
Yeah, I think she's there, Molly.
Yes, I am.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep, I'm here.
Do you regularly get 40 hours of work a week?
I do. I'm grandfathered in. The company just made it policy that all new hires can only work 30.
And that is that, yep. So they don't have to provide health insurance under the Affordable Care
Correct.
Act, right? Mm. Well, this is another problem we haven't talked about in terms of low-wage workers, particularly in the restaurant industry. But schedules for most workers in the industry are not standard. They don't have a regular pattern of hours every day, every week. And for the most part, even with the requirements of the Affordable Care Act aside, they aren't getting a full 40 hours of work. So they're making $7, $8, $9 an hour, and yet they're not even getting 40 hours of week of work each week mm-hmm. at that low wage. And so their total take-home pay each week, each month, each year is even lower than you would calculate it otherwise.
Thank you, Molly, very much for the call. There are some companies, of course, that are doing very nicely, thank you. We hear the most common complaint about raising the minimum wage, of course, Frank, is that companies just can't afford it. It would cut too deeply into their profits, or they're struggling to get by, particularly small businesses, and it would have the ultimate result of losing employees.
Well, we're on the radio, so I'm not going to say how I really feel, but let me say this. Our firm is a small firm. We're a small business, and that line of reasoning is simply nonsense. There are two ways to sort of look at this. First of all, in other parts of the world where health care is paid for, where health care is a right, the small business like ours and like hundreds and hundreds of others would now have enough money, more money, to pay the wages of workers, because they wouldn't be paying these outrageous and exploitative health care costs, okay, for those that are providing it. So the health care thing is the negative tax which reduces employment. That's the first thing, the existence of our current privatized health care system. Secondly, in terms of most small businesses, they're paying the minimum wage. And, the minimum wage is not enough. And if we take a look at the economics in these communities and whatnot, I would be very, very surprised. And there is no evidence that supports it, that by raising the minimum wage $2, that thousands of small businesses are going to go under. There's simply nothing in the literature. I mean, the people say it, but there's nothing in the statistics, nothing in the studies that supports the notion that an increase in minimum wage will drive people out of business. The likelihood is, and what is supported in the literature and the economic studies, is that when you increase the minimum wage, it automatically goes back into the economy and creates employment.
David, I know there are some states that have a higher than $7.25 minimum wage. How many are there, and how did that come to be?
Kathleen, I don't have the list of states in front of me, nor do I have the rates. But the interesting thing is that those that have higher minimum wages generally have a more healthy economy. We should remember, too, that essentially this argument that if we raise the minimum wage, we're going to destroy jobs is largely simply an excuse. It's part of the propaganda that corporations are using in order to keep wages low. The second thing is that if people have a higher minimum wage, this isn't going to come just in one firm. It's going to come across the board. And individual business owners often, when they're asked, what about, what would happen to your firm if you had to pay $2 more an hour, they're thinking that only they would have to pay that additional wage and their competitors would not have to. But that's why the minimum wage is so important, is that everyone has to pay it across the board. And so you keep a level playing field of competition between firms. The other thing, as Frank was indicating, is that if people are making decent wages, they're spending that money. And people in the lower half of the wage curve are people that, for the most part, are spending all of the money that they make. They have to, for rent, for health care, for food, for the necessities of life. So if you give them a little bit more money in their pocket, they're going to be spending that money, and that's going to be creating more jobs in the community.
Thanks, Molly, so much for your call. Prompted quite a conversation. Lynn in Eau Claire, hi.
Hi, Kathleen, David, and Frank. My great-grandfather was murdered at the Latimer Massacre. Along with his brother-in-law, he left a pregnant wife. Mm. That did not destroy the mining industry, by the way, as we can tell. I was raised in a union family. I raised my children in a union family. And we, my husband and I, cannot afford to retire because we're supplementing the incomes of a couple of my children who have not the benefit and the rights to work in a union. And as a child, I remember the jingle from the ILGWU, and look for the union label. It means we're able to make it in the USA. And I felt proud. I was proud of my father, who was a union man, and all the men on the street who worked in the same refinery that he did. We were, the union made us a family, and it took care of us. And we don't have that, and it breaks my heart because there's all that chatter, and we still buy the corporate spin and the divisiveness.
Frank, do you want to respond?
Well, except for my heart going out, I can't say it better. I think this is we see the destruction of a generation. We see hopes dashed. We see people working in their 60s and 70s because the kids can't get a house. I mean, this is not the kind of society we want. Nobody would look at Mississippi 10 years ago as a great place to live because everybody was starving to death, low wages and everything else. And now people talk about low wages if they're a great thing. I really have to take a deep breath and listen to what the speaker just said. We cannot continue the way we're going. And the ideas that the speaker just talked about, the pride, the dignity, the production in this country, this isn't going to come back because we like it. It's going to come back when people fight for it.
Thank you, Lynn, for your call. Ryan in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi there. I just had a question for the guest right now. I graduated from college about a year ago and have been in the workforce ever since. And I started off making $35,000 a year, and I'm still making the same now. And I guess what I'm wondering is, do you feel that raising the minimum wage so extremely to $15 an hour would disincentivize people from pursuing education that would ultimately land them at a job where they make that much anyways?
David?
Absolutely not. Because the minimum wage is important not just for those who are getting the precise amount of the minimum wage, but that's a wage floor. And when you raise the minimum wage, you're raising the wages above the minimum wage. So the caller who's making, about $16 an hour maybe, is going to find that if the minimum wage is raised, then his employer is probably going to raise his wages in order to stay competitive and to maintain the spread between the minimum wage and what he is being paid currently. So the benefits of putting more money in people's pockets in the low-wage sector has benefits far beyond those who are strictly at the minimum wage itself.
Thanks, Ryan, for the call. Let's go back to something David brought up, and that's the gap. And it's a large gap between those who run companies and those who are working for companies and low-wage workers particularly. Can you put this, Frank, in a historical perspective? Is it as large as it was in the Gilded Age? Can you explain to us why that has happened? Who's benefiting?
Well, who's benefiting? Well, that's clearer, but it's larger than in the Gilded Age. As a matter of fact, it's never been anything like this any place in the world. That's the first thing to say. And that, again, these figures are not mine. I read the Wall Street Journal. We do news, of course, as a thing. You know, so I read the paper every day. So the wage gap was about 60 times from the average worker around 1960. Now it's 256, something like that. So So it's worse than the Gilded Age, and it's, I think, unsustainable. Aside from what I think, why did this happen? Well, one of the articles I cite was a strategy that many of the companies had here in this country, and it was called the low-wage pump strategy. In other words, wages have been frozen since 1970. But productivity, which is what people, you know, can do in their hour, has almost doubled. In other words, there's more wealth being produced in a short period of time, an hour, okay? If there's more wealth being produced, which is documentable, and it's not being shared, then somebody's getting it, and the people getting it have been the stockholders and the owners of these various firms. So that's where the money has gone. And there's actually no question about that statistically or anecdotally or any other way. So the money is there. The distribution is not. And again, we're increasingly an outlier in terms of the world economy, and it destabilizes the economy. And it's, and I think, very scary when you talk about the future.
David, do you want to weigh in?
Frank is absolutely right. And if you look at just very simple figures of productivity and wages, and productivity meaning, as Frank was saying, the value that a worker can produce in 1 hour of work. And between the Second World War and the late 1970s, productivity was rising and wages were rising at basically the same percentage each year. So workers were reaping the benefits of their increased productivity. Then you see a break. And it comes very suddenly in the late 1970s. Productivity continues to rise at the same pace each year, but wages basically remain stagnant, which means that the additional wealth that workers are producing are not going to them. They're not being shared with those who create that wealth, but rather that that wealth is all being siphoned off to those at the very top of the income scale. And that's why we're seeing this increased inequality within our society that is becoming so corrosive and which is hollowing out the very essence of this country.
Well, welcome more phone calls. Our lines have been very busy. If you have been trying to get through, you could now. 800-486-8655 is the number. You can also leave messages for us by going to WPR.org or to our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, all ways of your reaching us. We're talking the couple days before Labor Day about what is a fair wage in this country. There are people who are walking out, have walked out in some 50 cities in this country of their low wage jobs to protest what the wage is. There is a Fair Minimum Wage Act of 2013 that sits before Congress that calls for the minimum wage to go up to $10.10 an hour in the next 3 years. We want to know what you think about all of this. We have two guests with us, David Newby, former president of the state AFL-CIO. Frank Emspach is founder and executive producer of Workers Independent News, professor emeritus in the School for Workers at UW-Madison. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls. Jim in West Bend is next. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to say that, you know, that this whole argument with you know, by raising the minimum wage, we have to lay off people, or we have to, you know, reduce our workforce or reduce our hours or something like that seems to be. I think there's a couple things that are always missing with that point. First of all, you know, the CEO wages are never part of the discussion. Corporate profits are never part of that discussion when they talk about that. I think there's some companies out there that actually prove that to be wrong to begin with. Companies like Costco, for example, that does a lot of the same type of things that Walmart does, and they pay much higher wages. You know, the CEO of Costco is making, what, about $375,000 a year, and yet he's able to pay a lot of his employees, and a number of them are union jobs with good wages and benefits and with respectable wages, and yet the company is very profitable. You know, so there's proof out there that shows that that is just not a correct statement, and, you know.
Frank.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, there are examples of people who are decent people or companies that are decent. I think what we have here is a greed factor where it doesn't matter what the facts are or that maybe, you know, not paying people properly is stupid or bad or worse or whatever. I think there's greed is very important. And I think that we see companies that have practiced something else to be more successful in the long run, as is Costco.
You, and I wanted to do a follow-up on this. We have a Facebook comment from Karen who says that her mother was amazed how professional the waitstaff and cabbies in Austria were. I explained that they were professionals, paid a family-supporting wage with health insurance and a pension. Are there other countries that do similarly, David?
Absolutely. Just about every European country has that kind of a wage structure and a benefit structure. Certainly the Scandinavian countries have the highest wages in the world, plus the best health care and education systems, which are open and accessible to their entire population. The United States is the outlier, both in terms of wages as well as health care, access to education, access to decent housing, good transportation. We simply don't, I mean, we think of ourselves as the richest country in the world. And that may be true if you lump everybody together and take an average. But that's only because you have all those super rich people at the top. In other countries, you have a more equitable distribution of wealth and a much healthier and happier society. That one of the interesting things is that there have been some studies recently which have indicated that the countries that have the most equal distribution of wealth also have the happiest populations as well as the healthiest populations and best educated.
Let's go to Ross in Madison. Hi, Ross.
Hi. Whenever the conversation comes up, if one is talking to a conservative, the argument is always, well, if we raise wages, we're just going to pass it on to the customer. I was wondering if there's, you know, I'm not, it sounds like it's been a long time since the last minimum wage pay increases happened, but has there been an honest analysis of the how much prices of those particular products went up after, for example, the last pay increase for a minimum wage?
The last was 2009, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's been about 6 or 7 years ago. Well, I think what we can say is this, that prices have gone up pretty consistently for the last 30 years, and the average wage has been frozen. So somewhere along the line, somebody was making money. In terms of the minimum wage, what would be the how would you measure it? If you're talking about hamburgers, you know, and you're talking about the food service industry, the amount that a hamburger would have to increase in price to pay for that, it'd be a couple of cents. And instead, what we see, I think, are all kinds of competition going on between Burger King and McDonald's to keep the prices stable or lower them. So it doesn't seem to have much of a correlation at the minimum level. I'm not saying that if wages are increased substantially, it won't be passed on. The automobile industry did that for years, which is one reason that some people don't like the UAW, because we paid for it. They didn't, because prices went up. But in terms of the minimum wage, I don't think there's any studies that indicate that there is huge price increases, because the relative increase compared to the relative price per product is not very great.
And thanks, Ross, very much for the call. Let's go next to Mike in Wausau. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, I'm an AFL-CIO retired member. And I campaigned Wimpasinger way back when, AFL-CIO, to fight for an increase in minimum wage. And I believe the AFL-CIO was the first union to do that. And I am now campaigning the Obama administration and his party to set minimum wage at a standard. In other words, a I don't know what you say, tidewater mark, where it will not slip behind again. I believe minimum wage will increase.
Oh, to index it. To index it, you mean. Yes, okay.
I believe a minimum wage will actually increase the economy, spending, sales, the GNP, because you can't spend what you're not earning. And those people who acquire their income by virtue of minimum wage, that money is immediately injected into the economy. And it also lowers the government burden on social programs. Now, I would throw up a suggestion, possibly minimum wage could be fixed to maybe twice the individual poverty rate. And unless my math is off, I think that'd be somewhere around $10.73 an hour.
David, you want to start response?
Well, I think the caller has nailed it in terms of what we need to do. And, you know, one of the things that would be good would be to raise a minimum wage and then index it for inflation. But that basically means that you're treading water. And he has a much better idea in terms of setting the minimum wage at a percentage of the poverty level and making sure that people have enough to have a decent life, that they are not living in poverty. But today they are. I mean, you look at the city of Milwaukee, for example, and 36% of the jobs in the city of Milwaukee are poverty-level jobs. Now, that is not a decent society. That is not a society which is taking care of its own population and making sure that people have a decent life. We have to change that. And it's not going to change by itself. It's going to change as a result of people organizing and putting pressure on our legislators that we elect and changing the political structure if we have to in order to make sure that people get what they need in order to have a decent life.
Thanks, Mike, so much for your call. Todd in Green Bay. Hello, Todd.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to say there's a phrase, give a man a fish. That helps him out maybe immediately, but then train him how to fish. I know that's a phrase that many people use, and I understand the need for a higher minimum wage, but wouldn't it be maybe more beneficial to our country in the future if we took maybe a little less money on the minimum wage and push more for companies to encourage or give them a tax benefit if they're encouraging their employees to get more education? Because that'll both help the person in the long run and maybe help those companies in the long run.
Frank.
Well, I think that's, for certainly education should be part of it, but let's take a look at what the companies have done. They had tax breaks for education and apprentice programs and so on and so forth and abolished them. This was particularly true with General Electric, but many, many others. So it doesn't look like that kind of indirect help does very much. Besides which, you have an immediate need in terms of people needing, you know, a decent wage. It's also not an either-or question. It seems to me that there's nothing, given the tremendous profits that most of the large firms have made, or given the richness of the society, that would prevent one from, A, raising the minimum wage so people can eat, because that's what we're talking about here, and, B, having the kind of accessible, high-quality vocational and technical education programs that we talk about all the time with our MATC system, which is perfectly well set up to do exactly what the caller wants, which is good training for good jobs that exist.
And thank you so much for the call. We have about a minute left. David, what needs to be done immediately to make workers' lives easier and more fulfilling?
Well, I don't think it's going to happen immediately because you have to organize, you have to create the pressure in order to change. And that's essentially, getting back to the March on Washington, that's essentially what the Civil Rights Movement did. They organized, they created the power and the pressure in order to change our society and change people's lives. We have to do the same with regard to our entire society, our entire economy, to make sure that there are decent jobs out there for everyone who is willing to work and to make sure that everyone is living at a decent standard of living. But we can't just expect that to drop in our laps. We have to do something. We have to act. We have to organize. We have to make the demands in order to make those changes.
Thank you, David. Thanks so much for being with us. Frank, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Happy early Labor Day to both of you.
Thank you, Kathleen.
David Newby, former president of the state AFL-CIO, and he was one of the marchers, March on Washington in 1963. And we thank Frank Emspach, who is a professor emeritus in the School for Workers at UW-Madison, founder and executive producer of Workers Independent News. Thanks to KP Whaley and Rhonda Fanning for producing this program. Thanks for all of your calls, everybody. Great conversations ahead. We'll be with you again Labor Day, not a live show Labor Day. We're going to take Labor Day off. And we'll present some of the more interesting shows that we've had in the past couple months. So that will be on Monday. So until Tuesday live, thanks for listening. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.